everybody. Ron Placone here. You are listening to the Indie Bohemians. We'll do some housekeeping to start out. First of all, this Friday night, March the 17th, I will be at the DeSano Pizza Bakery for all of our Los Angeles listeners. I don't know why I stumbled over that. I'll be at the DeSano Pizza Bakery in Los Angeles. That show kicks off at 8 p.m. And I will be going first. Because it's my girlfriend's birthday that day, so I asked to go first so that I could go participate in her birthday as soon as possible. So that's going on. And I mentioned that I'm going to be on the road a little less, and there were a lot of changes to my upcoming dates in both the end of March and April. First of all, I'll be at Minneapolis the end of this month. I'll be at a NACA conference there. Unfortunately, that's all I'll be doing. I was hoping to do some shows in the area. I am no longer able to. And also, the run in April is shortened significantly. Here are the final dates. April the 12th, I'll be at Toth's Place in Mentor, Ohio. April the 14th, Harrisburg Improv Theater, Harrisburg, PA. And for any listeners that are WLRI fans, or if you're not familiar with that affiliate, you can come check it out. They're running a, I don't know if promotion's the right word for it, but they're running a fun drive. That's what we're looking for, a fun drive, and you can get free admission to that show in Harrisburg. They're located not too terribly far from Harrisburg, so if you're looking for a fun Friday night out and want to help out progressive media at the same time, you can totally do that. So check them out for more information on that. Also, Pittsburgh, PA, April the 15th, got two shows. Show at 8 p.m. at Unplanned Comedy. That's a new venue in town. And at 10 p.m. we're doing a show at Ham Bones. That's myself and Patrick Cunningham. We are Morrissey's Favorite Bacon, a comedy tour. Ron, there were supposed to be a lot more dates. What's going on? Something you want to tell us? Yeah, I guess there is. I am now pretty much, I am now a producer of the Jimmy Dore Show. So I'm pretty much there full time, which I'm stoked about. I know some of you, the only reason you listen to this show is because you know me from the Jimmy Dore Show. Some of you guys may have been listening to me a lot longer and have been following me since I started contributing to that show. And yeah, I'm happy to be taking this step. It's a wonderful show. Jimmy is a really cool guy to work for. It's been an amazing experience so far, and I'm happy to be just part of all the shows that I'm affiliated with. Since coming to LA, I'm very proud to be affiliated with and very, very honored to be able to contribute and do my part with those shows. So anyway, that's and of course all the Jimmy Dore live shows in Los Angeles I will be part of in some capacity, either just on the production end of things and writing for them, or sometimes I open up with some stand-up, sometimes I do the panel. But I'll be around in some capacity on all of those. Housekeeping over, ronplacone.com for all the latest tour dates. And, of course, things are in a bit of transitionary period right now, but in a good way. And my guest this week is Maggie Rowe. She wrote a book called Sin Bravely, and it's about her time at an evangelical psychiatric camp, so to speak. And it was psychiatric care, all based on the Bible. What could possibly go wrong, right? And we talk about it. So this is a very religion-heavy episode. And speaking of religious experiences, I had one the other week. Tying it back to music, I went and saw Japandroids and Craig Finn. And, you know, Craig Finn's done the show before. Japandroids have not, but we got to get them at some point. I didn't have time to kind of rope them in this time around, but hopefully next time. For anyone that's not familiar, Japandroids are an amazing power duo out of Vancouver, British Columbia, one of my favorite cities. And I went, and it was my Valentine's Day gift. And man, was it a killer show. And it was just one of those, you know, I have to be careful with this because I've gotten in trouble. Not in trouble, but I've gotten, you know, Japandroids, they're one of those types. They're kind of a heavy guitar-driven indie band. And they tend to, and same with Craig Finn and the Hold Steady, they tend to be fairly heavy male-dominated in terms of their audience. Now, that's not to say there's a lot of females that love Japan Droids. There's a lot of women that love the Hold Steady, that love Craig Finn. I'm certainly not trying to cast too broad of a brushstroke here, but I have jokingly referred to this type of stuff as dude rock. Of course, it's in a joking manner. I don't mean anything by it. You know, at one time I was having a conversation, and I jokingly referred to Dinosaur Jr. as dude rock. It was, of course, in jest. Of course, I'm not implying that there's no, that only guys like Dinosaur Jr. It was more in a self-deprecating way, poking fun at myself. And this girl got a little offended. She was like, oh, I guess I'm a woman. I guess I can't listen to Dinosaur Jr. anymore. And I'm like, whoa, okay, you know, I totally didn't mean it like that. I meant it more in a self-deprecating way. Of course, that wasn't what I was implying. You know, I think that's a bit of a leap here. It was a joke. I'm really sorry, that you took it that way. I understand, you know, that's something we should be sensitive of. I get it. And I certainly wasn't trying to be, you know, I think you're being way too anally PC here. But you know, I still apologize nonetheless. I did say all that. And, I don't know if I smoothed the water out with her or not. But anyway, my point is, at the Japan, it was pretty much a lot of guys in the audience. I'd say it was about 70% male, and a lot of the females that were there were just people there with their boyfriends or husbands or whatever. And I was no different, and we all had this, that we all were just sort of, we all had our arms around our girlfriends as if to say, baby, thank you so much for being here. I don't know if you would be here otherwise. You're here for, you're the best. And I bet I'm not the only guy there that was like, this was my Valentine's Day gift from my extremely thoughtful girlfriend. And we all were just, thank you so much. And I was just, it was a killer show. It was just an amazing, they rocked it. And I was just experiencing this rock and roll with this fairly new relationship. And that was a religious experience for me, my friends. I don't, you know, you guys know I don't really have many beliefs, if any. And so that's where I find my catharsis. That's where I find my catharsis. And I'm adopting, you know, my girlfriend's a grown-up. And I'm not saying that I'm not, but I don't know if I really can wear that badge. But she is, she worries about how much sleep she gets. And I'm not saying that's bad. I'm just saying that's new for me. You know, occasionally she'll be like, oh, it's already X o'clock and I have to wake up at such and such and I'm going to be tired. I'm not getting enough sleep. What's going to happen? I'm like, I don't know. You just sleep more later. I mean, isn't that's what you do. You at a later time, you sleep more, and then you're good. I think that's it. That's all that happens. Hey, I moved to Los Angeles so I could get plenty of rest. That sentence doesn't make any sense. You know why? Because it's never been said before. It's been said for the first time just now by me to demonstrate how that doesn't really, that's not what you moved to Los Angeles for. I'm just saying, nobody, I got dreams and ambition of going to LA, getting plenty of sleep, getting so much Southern California, just all that, all those clouds, man, makes me want to sleep. I try to explain that to her, and she tries to explain to me how I'm a grown man and carbohydrates should no longer be 90% of my diet. And, we do a thing that, she tries to get me to lay off carbs. And I try to get her to lay off worrying about sleep so much, huh? Sleep, dead people sleep. That's what they do, right? So, I don't know. I feel like it's a good balance. And as far as the carb thing, I have a dinner tonight at an Italian restaurant. So this whole laying off of carbs thing, I'm going to lose tonight. Pretty sure I'm going to lose that tonight. She's doing fine. She has not had any carbs. Me, I've been eating chicken and vegetables and not really being a fan of the whole I can't have any rice or pasta. I can't have. I feel like peanut butter toast shouldn't count, but it does. And but tonight at this restaurant, I am going to. I'm gonna lose, and it's gonna taste delicious. Losing is. RomPlacone.com for all updates. You are listening to the Indie Bohemians.
Here's your Monkey Minute. I am Angie Doran for the Indie Bohemians. A dying autistic man in England with a lifelong passion for monkeys had a special visitor on his deathbed. Ian Cadman, age 58, who had more than 800 cuddly toy monkeys, met 2-year-old marmoset Millie on the day he died. Staff at Wigan and Lee Hospice, Greater Manchester, had planned to surprise him with a visit to nearby Knowsley Safari Park, but his ill health meant he was not able to go, so they arranged for the monkey to be brought to him. Mr. Cadman, who had been diagnosed with cancer of the colon just 5 weeks before, died a few hours later surrounded by his family. That's the Monkey Minute. I am Angie Doran for the Indie Bohemians.
Hey everybody, Ron Placone here. You are listening to the Indie Bohemians, and my guest today, we're hanging out in her lovely Hollywood home. She has a book out. Maggie Rowe, author of Sin Bravely. I keep hearing a lot about this book. You're tearing it up in L.A.
Thank you.
Reading after reading. and all the most important spots in town, too. Like all the places where if you do a signing here, your book matters. You've been there. You've done that.
There are very few bookstores that are left. One of them is Book
is
Soup.
True.
Yeah, they're all... I guess Amazon's coming out. They're going to have an actual bookstore now.
Oh,
did you
really?
Hear that?
Yeah. Oh, I don't know.
Oh, it's just going to crush all... Like, they haven't crushed all the other bookstores already.
Yeah.
Now they have to have a physical one to...
They're going to
really
it
nail it down.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm like, well, they're going to do to bookstores what Starbucks did to coffee. But that kind of already happened. I mean, Barnes & Noble...
Barnes & Noble. But even Barnes & Noble now, I'm like, well, at least it's not Amazon. I don't know why I think of Amazon as just being this monster, even though I use it all the time, of course.
Right. It is so convenient. I use it a lot, too.
Yeah.
And it's... But I see what you're saying. It's like, really, you're gonna... Yeah. It's the indies are so few and far between these days. And I feel like almost all of them are, like... Not on the West Coast, but like they're really concentrated now. Like it's like Portland's got Pals, LA's got Books Soup, Seattle has Elliot, Minnesota has that one store I'm not remembering the name of, and it's like you can kind of just all you need is a small spreadsheet now.
Yeah, that's
and
true.
You got everything.
But yeah, like Book Soup, I love that they have like everyone who works there does recommendations. So, you know, you go there, and if you want to talk, there's somebody physically there that you're talking to. Not at Amazon.
You got some great endorsements here. Bill Maher.
Yes.
Wrote a nice endorsement.
Yes.
Mitch Hurwitz, the creator of Arrested Development. Nice endorsement from him. And a fellow author of the New York Times bestseller and Thurber Prize finalist, I See You Made an Effort, Annabelle Gurwitch. Also, another fine testimonial.
Thank you.
So,
yeah, it was nice.
You've been getting some great reviews. So let's jump right into it. What is what's going on in Sin Bravely?
Sin Bravely is about the 3 months that I spent in an evangelical psychiatric institute, which most people don't know that these things exist. The place was called Grace Point, and their slogan was psychiatry where the Bible comes first.
Ooh, okay.
So already that creates, it's not where mental health comes first. It's where the Bible comes first.
How old were you?
I was 19.
19-year-old girl in a psychiatric ward where the Bible comes first.
Where the Bible
what
comes
could
first.
Possibly go wrong?
Yes, that's very, very true.
So what led you there? Why'd you go there?
It is the simplest reason, which is elegant in some way and ridiculous in another. I was scared of going to hell. I really, really was. And it was not that my parents were hyper-religious. They were actually very moderate Christians. But when I was five, my Sunday school teacher told us to imagine the worst thing we could ever imagine happening to us. And I imagined my parents dying and it being my fault, like I had poisoned them by forgetting to refrigerate the milk or something. Okay. And then she put a little dot on the board and she said, now imagine this dot is 1 year of that feeling. And then she dragged the chalk across the board and said, now imagine that feeling going on forever and ever and ever and ever. That's hell. But there was a way out. You just had to say this prayer. You had to say, dear Lord, I accept your son into my heart as my personal savior. And if you said that, you were okay. But the catch was you had to mean it with all of your heart. So there was a verse in the Bible that says, if you are neither hot nor cold for the Lord, then God will spit you out of his mouth on judgment day if you are lukewarm. And I was like, I don't know if I'm lukewarm. I don't, you know, I don't feel like I'm on fire for the Lord. I just want to, you know, watch the Brady Bunch and have cupcakes.
What happens if you're cold? They say neither hot nor cold. I would have that question.
Yeah, absolutely. Why? That's, you know what? And nobody has asked me that. It's true. Why would cold be worse, better than being lukewarm? I think the idea is that if you're cold, you're more likely to convert at a later point in time. That if you're lukewarm, you'll just meander along. You're
okay.
Indifferent.
All right, all right.
And the indifference was somehow more damning. But for a kid trying to compute these ideas that are so theoretical and non-tangible, you know, there's not a certificate that comes in the mail that says, the prayer worked. You're saved. It took.
Yeah.
So I was always trying to prove to God, but also to myself, so I could relax, that I really was a Christian. So I was one of those people that went to shopping malls and, you know, would go up to people and tell them the good news that they were going to hell. But there was a but there was a way out.
And this wasn't like family stuff.
Not
where was
family.
This
was in Chicago. Outside
of Chicago.
My parents never did anything like that.
All right.
But they told me that I didn't have to. I mean, I hated it. I hated it.
You hated what?
No. Hated going to the shopping malls and doing the witnessing at shopping malls. You know, I felt this. Like if I was on an airplane, you know, they would tell us in Sunday school, any chance you have to witness, which meant to proselytize or try to convert somebody, you should take it, because if they don't come to Christ in their lifetime, it's kind of on your head. So,
wow, no pressure.
Yeah, no pressure, no pressure. So I would just force myself, you know, like I totally remember doing this on airplanes, like trying to like work it naturally into conversation, you know, like I'd talk to the adult next to me and I'd be like, hi, I'm Maggie. This is one of the first times I've flown on an airplane. It seems like you might be a little nervous too. You might also be nervous about what happens to you after you die.
Wow, that's a quick hit. Huh? It's not even a 30-second elevator. You really go in for the kill there.
You just gotta get in there and make it happen. You could also, another way to witness was to wear something that indicated that you were a Christian and then behave really, really well so that everyone would go, you know, what is this Christianity thing? I think I want some of this.
How does one behave really, really well on like an airplane per se?
Just the idea was, there's a verse, you will know that they are Christians by their love.
Okay.
So the whole idea was you were supposed to try to demonstrate constantly at every point how loving you were so that people would be attracted to whatever it was that you had. But the thing was, I hated what I had. It scared me to death.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but still, that was the thing that I felt like I needed to push onto other people.
So Sunday school was the big thing. That was what pushed you to all this.
Yes, but none of the other people that I went to Sunday school with had this particular issue. So it was also, I had OCD, you know, I could, and my particular form of obsessive rumination it just found religion and it attached to it in a different circumstance. You know, I don't know, I could have been a hand washer if, you know, germs were, you know,
right.
talked about as
but
much
your
as hell.
But my big thing was hell. I have this dude in the sky that's watching me, and if I mess up, I'm going to hell. Although, I've read the Bible cover to cover, you know, because YOLO. Yep. But but I don't remember the cold verse. But now I'm thinking, well, I guess I can still get. See, I was raised Catholic, and to quote George Carlin, I practiced Catholicism until I reached the age of reason. But
I haven't heard that before, actually.
That's a Carlin. Yeah, that's one of his. But it applies to me too, and millions of others.
Yeah.
But I remember they told us, like, God is in your image. And so I'm just thinking, well, if God, the way I picture God is like the dude from Big Lebowski.
Yes.
So if the hot and cold thing is legit, then I just picture, like, I'm going to die. There's going to be a gate, and there's going to be St. Peter. And I'm going to be like, oh, snap. I was wrong, huh? I missed the boat here. I even had a chance, and I said, nope, not for me. Don't think so. And then the dude will come over and he'll be like, yeah, man, I know that stuff was pretty unbelievable, but all the people that think for themselves, I let them in anyway because you guys are more interesting to talk to. And then I get, and that's why he lets the cold people. That's how I imagine it going down.
That's a little loophole.
So I feel like I totally have all my bases covered.
I remember there was something on South Park where it was the situation. It was this, you know. A guy, a bunch of people after they had died, and there was heaven and there was hell, and God took the microphone and said, all right, everyone, so the right answer was Mormonism. And like, the Jehovah's Witnesses were like, I almost went that way. I almost.
Brilliant. So you're in Chicago, you're doing this. Were your parents ever like, hey, maybe you shouldn't be going to Sunday school anymore?
Well, they actually went the opposite way. They thought that they had me get baptized earlier than the rest of the kids and set up regular meetings for me with the pastor. They thought actually pushing me more into the church was going to be the thing that would offer me assurance.
Okay. Offer you assurance?
They thought, and it was a reasonable guess. They thought if I was baptized and I went up in front of the congregation and made this very public declaration, that then I would finally go, okay.
Oh, so it was more like they were aware that you had kind of an OCD thing going
yes.
on. Yes. That was the concerning part. But they're like, okay, this subscription is helping you, we think.
We think this.
And so, you know, let's get your papers in order.
Yes.
And, you know, you're good.
Then you're good.
You got your policy here.
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay. And it was a reasonable thought. And I, you know, anticipated this great, you know, transformation. I was hoping that, you know, when I was dunked into the water, a nervous, you know, agitated child, that I would come up fresh and relaxed and free of all worries. And that was not the case at all. In fact, I had bought purple underwear from Contempo Casuals that I was wearing under the baptismal gown. And I realized that when I was dunked under, that they were going to show through, and I just felt like I was doing this horrible thing in front of the Lord and the congregation by wearing what in my mind was racy underwear. Because
they were purple.
Because they were purple. Well,
what would your other alternative have been? I mean, if you just wore like white, then it could have just been totally see-through, right? And then you would have just been...
It could be. But I had this feeling that underwear, like I knew I had bought it because it seemed...
You liked it.
I liked
it. You were into it. Okay.
I was into it. And in my child's mind, that was even more confirmation that I had not really been converted or saved.
Oh, wow. Wow. Like God's like, yeah, you did the right thing with the bat, but the underwear choice.
Gee,
totally
what are we going to, you're in front of 200 people. You're going to wear
the purple underwear? That's...
Oh, Maggie.
You should have known God's a brief guy. And,
yeah.
Yes. Now you're going to pay forever.
Right. And Contempo Casuals seemed also racy. Like, it wasn't like Sears or Penny's. It was where the teenagers shopped.
Oh, you know? Okay. Gotcha.
So they were like older girl underwear.
So this went on for a while then, because like you were, I mean, when were you baptized? How old were you then?
I was 9.
You were 9?
Yeah.
So you had 10 years of this stuff.
I had 10 years.
Okay. Well, how, I mean, did it affect your, well, I mean, clearly it did, but like, were there any specific ways? How did you feel when it was time to go to your first high school dance? How did you feel at prom? How did you feel at, or were those just like not doing it?
Every decision that I made, you know, I would go to prom. There was nothing, I went to prom. There wasn't anything sinful about that. Mm-hmm. But every decision I made sure it kept in line with the Bible.
Okay.
Like, we were taught that you weren't, you know, when I was in high school, you weren't supposed to do anything more than kissing, mm-hmm. you know, or teacher said you should save petting for the pets.
It's quite a way to put it.
Yeah, quite a way to put it.
If you have sexual urges, you're an animal.
Yes.
Sleep tight. Which technically we are, but I embrace that part of it.
I didn't lie. I didn't swear. I wouldn't drink at parties. You know, when the popular girls would want to cheat off my test in biology, I would have to say, no, I'm sorry, I'm a Christian, and then, like, shield the word mitochondria with my elbow, you know? Like, so I walked the walk, and the only time that I was pet, I was dating this guy who said that if I let him touch my boobs, he would accept Jesus as his personal savior.
See, we're taking one for the team. This guy knew what he was doing.
He knew me well.
He's like, these are the only types of girls I date.
I know how to get in there. So I was like, well, 2 boobs touched, 1 soul saved. So.
Wow. What? You know what? Are you still in touch with that dude? Because that might still be his forte. He might be like... Like, you might be married now. It's like, how'd you meet your wife? Like, well, this guy came up to me and said, I had a vision where God saw us making babies together. And then totally. I just knew. Just and like, he's like, yeah, I've been playing this game for years.
It's not staring me wrong. Yes.
He's like, I'm the biggest atheist you will ever meet. Don't tell her.
But yeah, so I walked the walk. I did the thing. And then in college, I gradually started doing things that would have been prohibited by the church, but I justified them.
Don't we all?
Yes.
So where was college?
In Ithaca, New York, at Cornell.
Okay. All right, so you got out a little bit.
Yep, I got out, and but anything I did, I justified in some way. So I started drinking, but I justified it by saying there's this verse that says, do not drink unto debauchery. So I figured, okay, well, it's okay to drink as long as I don't do any debauching. And then I started debauching. I started having sex with my college boyfriend.
Oh,
But my justification.
He was like, I'm saved, so it's good.
Well, my justification was that nowhere in the Bible does it say you have to have a legal marriage ceremony performed in order to be married. All it says is that you have to only have sex with one person until either you die or that person dies. So we were committed to be together forever. Mm. So I decided that we were married in God's eyes.
Okay.
That was my justification.
What was that? I mean, was he on board with all that? Like, you were like, so I need to be, and he's like, yeah, whatever. Or was he into it too?
We had been dating for a year and a half.
Uh-huh.
So actually we were pretty serious about getting married.
Yeah, if you take that long in college. Like, I feel like that's like 5 years in normal time.
Yeah, yeah. That was the plan. So then, in a very, very strange, life-altering moment, we went to see this art house film, Kurosawa's Dreams. And it's, it's a very imagistic film, basically about fear of the afterlife and justice and punishment for wrongdoing. In the first little vignette, there's a boy that disobeys his mother, and he tells his mother what he did, and the mother gives him a sword to drive into his stomach, which, like, just kind of shook me. And then there's one where these They're frozen mountaineers that are hiking in a snowstorm and they slowly freeze to death. And I started wondering if they had accepted Jesus as their savior, if they were really saved. And then it just, like, all of the unconscious stuff that I could push down just rushed to the surface. And I had this kind of almost out-of-body experience where everyone in the theater started to look like corpses to me.
Oh, wow.
And I was, like, trying to inhale or exhale, but I couldn't figure out how to do either. So I was just holding. And then I heard this, like, yelping sound and realized it was coming from my own mouth. So
it was like everything that was repressed got triggered.
Yep.
Right?
And
okay.
One, I mean, unbelievable. I mean, it's still like staggering to me. It was one moment and it just all broke loose. The following morning I told my boyfriend I could no longer have sex with him. I stopped drinking. I recommitted myself to Christ and, you know, begged forgiveness. But I just felt like I had messed everything up and that I was doomed. So I pretty much stopped eating.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really, really, really bad. So I told my parents and they found me this place called Grace Point because okay. I told them I needed, I mean, I couldn't have done like therapy once a week. You know, it was like I needed full immersion. I was just...
Now, was it in upstate New York or was it you
no.
had to pack your bag?
Yeah, so I packed my bags.
So you dropped out of school.
And went to... it's about probably an hour and a half from my house was the place that I
okay.
went. So it's in the Midwest.
Was it in Illinois? Or?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It was in Illinois. I'm not supposed to say the name of the place.
All
the,
right, okay.
the real name.
Right,
but it's
okay.
similar to Grace Point.
Okay.
but yeah, and I basically... told the admitting psychologist, I was like, I need help. And she signed me up. And the next day, I was there. And it's not like a traditional hospital or like a scary psych ward. So when I use institute, that kind of sounds weird. It was a hospital, but we each had our own little room, you know, it wasn't this sanitary hospital feel. I mean, there were doctors that prescribed medicine. But every day we had activities, we had group therapy, we had individual therapy, we did artwork, we had exercise therapy. There was like a 12-step program where everyone's higher power had to have a son named Jesus. You know, there was no like wiggle room of thinking about higher powers, your innate ability to heal or anything like
okay.
that.
It was very
prescribed. Yeah. So I was there for 3 months with a bunch of people that I never would have been with otherwise. It was very different than my traditional liberal arts
right.
college.
And you go through your experiences in the book.
In the book, yes.
That's
the main bulk of my book. There are flashbacks to my childhood, but essentially it's about my time there and the other patients' journeys, too.
Oh, yeah. So it's almost got like a One Flew Over the Cuckoo's
yes.
Nest vibe,
yeah.
but this all happened.
This all happened.
In a particular...
And we were all there voluntarily, which I think creates a lot more inner conflict. Like in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest... He's trapped. He doesn't...
Yeah, he's trapped. Except for, like, the one dude that seemed the most normal of the bunch.
Right.
But it was, like, for him, it was just his wife left him, right? He's
yeah,
like, oh,
yeah.
I'm here on my own accord because my wife left me and I can't handle it.
Yeah.
I think he put it more delicately, but that was
But I think that was the idea.
That was essentially his 411.
Right, exactly.
And McMurphy didn't like that.
No.
Right? That was the... Yeah. Okay.
That was the thing. So everybody was there by choice. They had all, like... willingly uprooted their entire lives to put themselves in the care of these therapists who were not all that well trained. Some of them. I had one fantastic therapist that ended up kind of saving me. But my individual therapist was a woman named Bethany, who, when I told her that I would get so upset about my salvation that I would throw up, told me that I had body issues, that I was bulimic. And the more I denied it, the more it confirmed her theory. And she told me that throwing up, she was like, it strips the enamel from your teeth. And I think you should save those pearly whites for the pearly gates.
Wow.
I was like, no, I'm not worried about my weight. It's the last thing. And she was like, Jesus will love you even if you are not a size 6.
Wow.
And I'm like, I know he doesn't care about my weight. Nobody cares about my weight.
So she was determined. She's like, no,
I've diagnosed this.
More than you.
Yes.
Wow. And that saved the pearly whites for
the pearly gates.
Because, I mean, you got that purple underwear on your resume.
Right.
So it's like, you already got like a strike. So it's like, well, you kept up on the dental. We'll let you in. Purple underwear, that was a strike. You saved yourself.
Yeah. And she would misdiagnose, not even misdiagnose. There was my best friend there was a woman named Kathy, who was a depressive, and her deepest sadness was that she couldn't have children, but she would be able to do in vitro. But she had written to Oral Roberts, who she decided was just the arbiter of all things good or bad on the planet Earth, and he told her that life should begin in a loving marital bed and not as a result of a laboratory experiment.
Oh, it's terrible.
Terrible.
Okay.
But so she shared in group about being molested by her father, who was deceased. And she had written a letter to express how she felt to her deceased father, who obviously was never going to hear this letter.
Mm-hmm.
And she started to say, how could you be so effing cruel? And Bethany stopped her and said, woo, language, let's just steer that back. Mm. And so she had to be like, how could you be such a jerk? You know, but clearly it was, you know, she needed to be able to express this rage.
Yeah.
And the container of the word jerk, like, just didn't
ridiculous.
Cut it.
Right.
Like the catharsis that at any other psychiatric facility would have been allowed and encouraged was explicitly discouraged here.
Yeah. Yeah. And that matters.
It matters.
Really matters. Like, sometimes you got to just let it out.
Yeah. Yeah.
And say however you got to say it.
Right. Right. Like, she needed those words and she was denied them, I felt.
So you go through the 3 months
with these characters.
Well, what made you, and you know, anything specific you want to share, go for it. But I know that's the content of the book.
But how
was the dynamic of you getting out then? Were you like, this is a failure, this is a success, this is not for me, I have a change of heart? Like how did that unfold?
Here's what happened. So I had this amazing therapist who was a real renegade iconoclast. He didn't openly combat the dogma that was being taught us, but in private kind of undermined it. So he was the one, this is where the title of the book comes from, he told me a quote from Martin Luther, which was, sin bravely in order to know the forgiveness of God. And his instruction to me was to do all of the sins that I wanted to do, because the most important thing was to feel God's grace. And every time I stopped myself from doing something just because I thought it was bad, I was just reinforcing my doubt and resentment of God. So the big thing that I did, it's the climax of my book, is I decided to go to a local strip club amateur night in order to sin bravely. And I mean, it was ridiculous. I had like my matching pink bra and underwear that I'd gotten from TJ Maxx.
Back the purple.
No, purple.
Okay, because I thought this might come full circle.
Hot pink. It was close. But yeah, the same idea. So I went. I got a cab. I went to this club. I went up on stage, and of course, I had no idea what to do. But I did like the tour jetés and shuffle ball changes I'd learned in the Glenview Park District Jazz 2 class.
Okay, all right.
Do-si-do'd around the pole. And afterwards, I had immediately afterwards a feeling of exhilaration. Like, and my heart was beating really, really fast. And that feeling of excitement then quickly turned to panic. And okay. I was like, what have I done? Like, have I taken this advice and just damned myself by doing this? But then there was something that kind of released in me, and I just trusted this idea that God would still love me. Like, and I ended up still being scared of hell essentially for the next 10 years.
Okay.
So it wasn't like it was a nice little bow that I tied up. But there was a sense of relief in this idea of, you know, this doctor telling me, therapist telling me, you're not going to go out and murder people. You're not going to be, you know, robbing banks. Just do what your heart feels is okay. And in my heart, I didn't feel like having sex with my boyfriend was wrong. So I tried after that point, I guess, to follow my gut and trust that I was forgiven. I still believed the dogma at that point.
Okay.
So I got some sense of relief. And so it was my decision to leave. So I made the decision after 3 months to then go back to school.
Okay. So still on the team.
Still on the team.
But got a little more practical perspective.
Yeah.
Right? Is that
okay? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so then what happened to, when did this become dogma to you?
When did I let it go?
Yeah. When were you like, no thanks?
Oh, no thanks.
Yeah.
It was a very, very gradual process that happened probably over a period of 10 years. It really did take me that long. The first thing that I did, which was really helpful to me, it seemed like it was sinning. I started to picture God as a woman.
Okay.
And it actually helped me. It was just the image of a female. So that was kind of one step. And then I started thinking, okay, maybe heaven and hell are just a metaphor for our present tense experience.
Mm-hmm.
That was one step. And then I started thinking, well, maybe a lot more of this is figurative and not literal. And then I started thinking, maybe all of this is figurative. Maybe all of this is just poetry and stories and letters to describe a present day experience rather than a historical document that was predicting a future afterlife. But it took a bunch of steps and a long time.
Well, what's your I guess spiritual identity now?
I'm a member of a Zen center here.
Oh, really?
So if I had to identify as anything, I would say Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
But I still follow some Christian writers, Rob Bell, Peter Rollins, who both tend to look at the Bible in more figurative language. So I enjoy their perspectives. So I wouldn't necessarily label myself one or another, but meditation was a big help for me in getting over these anxieties and OCD, which was really what it was. Just being able to watch my mind, watch it do its fear thing, and be able to say, I mean, it's the scariest thing in the world to say, but it was like, I have to accept that I might go to hell, which was horrifying, but it was exactly what I needed to do.
Like, wow.
Because I would never get certainty.
Mm-hmm.
So I just decided, I've got to, like Huck Finn. I was like, all right, then I'll go to hell.
Yeah.
You know?
No, so I'm actually an SGI, Nichiren Buddhist.
Myself. Oh, really?
Yeah. Not a lot of people know that about me, but I do talk about it on the show some.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, for me, it was the chanting. It really helped me. You know, I over the years, I've not had the world's greatest temper.
Hmm.
And chanting was the biggest thing that helped me with that. I mean, and there have been a lot of things that have helped me with that, and a lot of things that have done the opposite.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But chanting was the big thing that helped me, that I could do on my own.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
It was like exercising for mental stillness.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
Like that.
Clarity,
whatever.
Or stability.
Yeah,
yeah,
it gave
yeah.
me that clarity, and it allowed me to, you know, kind of express what's wrong instead of bottling it up and then flipping out. You know, so that was like the big thing for me. So where can people learn more about the book and learn more about you?
So I have a website, MaggieRowAuthor.com. That's more about me and the book and reviews and...
You got anything cool coming up?
Yes. Well, I'm going to be in the LA Book Festival coming up, and I'm going to speak at a, Christian, seminary.
Interesting. Okay.
Which I'm really excited about.
A reform member, but they got some perspective here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I'm doing that in April. So I'm kind of excited about that and happy that they were open enough to have somebody like me speak to the students.
Okay, cool. And for more information, of course, go to MaggieRowAuthor.com. Yeah. Thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you.